Thank you. I think we have a question here on international affairs, hopefully.
We've come to a position where we're in a new world order, and I'd like to know what the candidates feel our position is in this new world order and what our responsibilities are as a superpower.
Mr. President?
Well, we have come to that position. Since I became president, 44 countries have gone democratic, no longer totalitarian, no longer living under dictatorship or communist rule. This is exciting. This is new world order to me means freedom and democracy. I think we will have a continuing responsibility as the only remaining superpower to stay involved. If we pull back in some isolation and say we don't have to do our share or more than our share anymore, I believe you're going to just ask for conflagration that we'll get involved in the future. NATO, for example, has kept the peace for many, many years, and I want to see us keep fully staffed in NATO so we'll continue to guarantee the peace in Europe. But the exciting thing is the fear of nuclear war is down, and you hear all the bad stuff that's happened on my watch. I hope people will recognize that this is something pretty good for mankind. I hope they'll think it's good that democracy and freedom is on the move. And we're going to stay engaged, as long as I'm president, working to improve things. You know, it's so easy now to say, hey, cut out foreign aid. We got a problem at home. I think the United States has to still have the Statue of Liberty as a symbol, caring for others. We're right this very minute, we're sending supplies in to help these little starving kids in Somalia. We're trying to get, it's the United States that's taking the lead in humanitarian aid into Bosnia. We're doing this all around the world. And yes, we got problems at home. And I think I got a good plan to help fix those problems at home. But because of our leadership, because we didn't listen to the nuclear freeze group, do you remember? Freeze it back in about the late 70s. Freeze, don't touch it. We're going to lock it in now or else we'll have war. President Reagan said, no, peace through strength. It worked. The Soviet Union is no more, and now we're working to help them become totally democratic through the Freedom Support Act that I led on, a great Democratic ambassador, Bob Strauss over there, Jim Baker, all of us got this thing passed through cooperation, Ross. It worked with cooperation, and you're for that, I'm sure, helping Russia become democratic. So the New World Order to me means freedom and democracy. Keep engaged. Do not pull back into isolation, and we are the United States, and we have a responsibility to lead and to guarantee the security. If it hadn't been for us, Saddam Hussein would be sitting on top of 3/5 of the oil supply of the world, and he'd have nuclear weapons. And only the United States could do that. Excuse me, Carol.
Thank you. Mr. Perot.
Well, it's cost-effective to help Russia succeed in its revolution. It's pennies on the dollar compared to going back to the Cold War. Russia's still very unstable. They could go back to square one and worse. There's still, all the nuclear weapons are not dismantled. I'm particularly concerned about the intercontinental weapons, the ones that can hit us. We've got agreements, but they're still there. With all this instability and breaking into republics and all the Middle Eastern countries going over there and shopping for weapons, we've got our work cut out for us. So we need to stay right on top of that and constructively help them move toward democracy and capitalism. We have to have money to do that. We have to have our people at work. See, for 45 years, we were preoccupied with the Red Army. I suggest now that our number one preoccupation is red ink in our country. And we've got to put our people back to work so that we can afford to do these things we want to do in Russia. We cannot be the policeman for the world any longer. We spend $300 billion a year defending the world. Germany and Japan spend around $30 billion apiece. It's neat. If I can get you to defend me and I can spend all my money building industry, that's a home run for me. Coming out of World War II, it made sense. Now, the other superpowers need to do their part. I'll close on this point. You can't be a superpower unless you're an economic superpower. If we're not an economic superpower, we're a used to be, and we will no longer be a force for good throughout the world. And if nothing else gets you excited about rebuilding our industrial base, maybe that will, because it's job one is to put our people back to work.
Governor Clinton, the president mentioned Saddam Hussein, your vice president, and you have had some words about the president and Saddam Hussein. Would you care to comment?
I'd rather answer her question first, okay. And I'll be glad to, because the question you ask is important. The end of the Cold War brings an incredible opportunity for change. Winds of freedom blowing around the world, Russia, demilitarizing. And it also requires us to maintain some continuity, some bipartisan American commitment to certain principles. And I would just say there are three things that I would like to say. Number one, we do have to maintain the world's strongest defense. We may differ about what the elements of that are. I think the defense needs to be with fewer people in permanent armed services, but with greater mobility on the land, in the air, and on the sea, with a real dedication to continuing development of high-technology weaponry and well-trained people. I think we're going to have to work to stop the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. We've got to keep going until all those nuclear weapons in Russia are gone and the other republics. Number two, if you don't rebuild the economic strength of this country at home, we won't be a superpower. We can't have any more instances like what happened when Mr. Bush went to Japan and the Japanese Prime Minister said he felt sympathy for our country. We have to be the strongest economic power in the world. That's what got me into this race, so we could rebuild the American economy. And number three, we need to be a force for freedom and democracy, and we need to use our unique position to support freedom, whether it's in Haiti or in China or in any other place, wherever the seeds of freedom are sprouting. We can't impose it, but we need to nourish it. And that's the kind of thing that I would do as president, follow those three commitments into the future.
Okay, we have a question up there.
Yes, we've talked a lot tonight about creating jobs, but we have an awful lot of high school graduates who don't know how to read a ruler, who cannot fill out an application for a job. How can we create high-paying jobs with the education system we have? And what would you do to change it? Thank
you. Who would like to begin? The education president?
Go ahead. Yeah.
Mr. President?
I'd be delighted to, because you can't do it the old way. You can't do it with the school bureaucracy controlling everything. And that's why we have a new program that I hope people have heard about. It's being worked now in 1,700 communities. Bypass Congress on this one, Ross. 1,700 communities across the country. It's called America 2000. And it literally says to the communities, reinvent the schools. Not just the bricks and mortar, but the curriculum and everything else. Think anew. We have a concept called the New American School Corporation, where we're doing exactly that. And so I believe that we got to get the power in the hands of the teachers, not the teachers' union. What's happening up there? So our America 2000 program also says this. It says, let's give parents the choice of a public, private, or public school. Public, private, or religious school. And it works. It works in Milwaukee. Democratic woman up there taking the lead in this, the mayor up there on the program. And the schools that are not chosen are improved. Competition does that. So we've got to innovate through school choice. We've got to innovate through this America 2000 program. But she is absolutely right. The programs that we've been trying, where you control everything and mandate it from Washington, don't work. The governors, and I believe Governor Clinton was in on this, but maybe I don't want to invoke him here, but they come to me and they say, please get the Congress to stop passing so many mandates telling us how to control things. We know better how to do it in California or Texas or wherever it is. So this is what our program is all about. And I believe it. You're right on to something, that if we don't change the education, we're not going to be able to compete. Federal funding for education is up substantially. Pell grants are up. But it isn't going to get the job done if we don't change K through 12.
Governor Clinton?
First of all, let me say that I've spent more of my time and life on this in the last 12 years than any other issue. 70% of my state's money goes to public schools, and I was really honored when Time magazine said that our schools had shown more improvement than any other state in the country except one other. They named two states showing real strides forward in the 80s. So I care a lot about this, and I spent countless hours in schools. But let me start with what you said. I agree with some of what Mr. Bush said, but it's nowhere near enough. We live in a world where what you earn depends on what you can learn, where the average 18-year-old will change jobs 8 times in a lifetime, and where none of us can promise any of you that what you now do for a living is absolutely safe from now on. Nobody running can promise that. There's too much change in the world. So what should we do? Let me reel some things off real quick, because you said you wanted specifics. Number one, under my program, We would provide matching funds to states to teach everybody with a job to read in the next 5 years and give everybody with a job the chance to get a high school diploma in big places on the job. Number two, we would provide two-year apprenticeship programs to high school graduates who don't go to college and community colleges are on the job. Number three, we'd open the doors to college education to high school graduates without regard to income. They could borrow the money and pay it back as a percentage of their income over the couple of years of service to our nation here at home. Number four, we would fully fund the Head Start program to get little kids off to a good start. And five, I would have an aggressive program of school reform. More choices in the I favor public schools or these new charter schools. We can talk about that if you want. I don't think we should spend tax money on private schools, but I favor public school choice, and I favor radical decentralization and giving more power to better trained principals and teachers with parent councils to control their schools. Those things would revolutionize American education and take us to the top economically.
Thank you, Governor Clinton. What the question is, what is it going to cost? What is it going to cost?
In 6 years, I budget all this in my budget. In 6 years, the college program would cost $8 billion over and above what the present student loan program costs for. You pay $3 billion for busted loans because we don't have an automatic recovery system, and $1 billion in bank fees. So the net cost would be $8 billion 6 years from now in a trillion-plus budget, not very much. The other stuff, all the other stuff I mentioned, costs much less than that. The Head Start program full funding would cost about $5 billion more. And it's all covered in my budget from the plans that I've laid out, from raising taxes on families with incomes above $200,000 and asking foreign corporations to pay the same tax that American corporations do on the same income, from $140 billion in budget cuts, including what I think are very prudent cuts in the defense budget.
It's all covered. Mr. Perot, you on education, please.
Yes, I've got scars to show for being around education reform. And the first word you need to say in every city and state, and just draw a line in the sand, the public schools exist for the benefit of the children. You're going to see a lot of people fall over. Because anytime you're spending $199 billion a year, somebody's getting it. And the children get lost in the process. So that's step one. Keep in mind, in 1960, when our schools were the envy of the world, we were spending $16 billion on them. Now we spend more than any other nation in the world, $199 billion a year, and rank at the bottom of the industrialized world in terms of education achievement. One more time, you brought a front row box seat and got a third-rate performance. It's a government that's not serving you. By and large, it should be local. The more local, the better. Interesting phenomenon. Small towns have good schools. Big cities have terrible schools. The best people in a small town will serve on the school board. You get into big cities, it's political patronage, stepping stones. You get the job, give your relatives the janitor's jobs at $57,000 a year, more than the teachers make, and with luck, they clean the cafeteria once a week. Now, you're paying for that. Those schools belong to you. And we put up with that. And as long as you put up with that, that's what you're going to get. And these folks are just dividing up $199 billion and the children get lost. If I could wish for one thing for great public schools, it'd be a strong family unit in every home. Nothing will ever replace that. You say, well, gee, what are you going to do about that? Well, the White House is a bully pulpit, and I think we ought to be pounding on the table every day. There's nothing, the most efficient unit of government the world will ever know is a strong, loving family unit. Next thing, you need small schools, not big schools. A little school, everybody's somebody. Individualism is very important. These big factories, everybody told me they were cost-effective. I did a study on it. They're cost-ineffective. 5,000 students, why is a high school that big? One reason. Sooner or later, you get 11 more boys that can run like the devil, that weigh 250 pounds, and they might win district. Now, that has nothing to do with learning. Secondly, across Texas, typically half the school day was non-academic pursuits. In one place, it was 35%. In Texas, you could have unlimited absences to go to livestock shows. Found a boy, excuse me, but you got this gives the flavor. Boy in Houston kept a chicken in the bathtub in downtown Houston. Missed 65 days going to livestock shows. Finally had to come back in school. The chicken lost his feathers. That's the only way we got him back. Now, that's your tax money being wasted. Now, neighborhood schools. It is terrible to bus tiny little children across town. And it is particularly terrible to take poor, tiny little children and wait until the first grade and bus them across town to Mars, where the children know their numbers, know their letters, have had every advantage at the end of the first day that little child wants out. I'll close on this. You've got to have world-class teachers, world-class books. If you ever got close to how textbooks were selected, you wouldn't want to go back the second day. I don't have time to tell you the stories.
No, you don't.
Finally. But this, if we don't fix this, you're right. We can't have the industries of tomorrow unless we have the best educated workforce. And here you've got, for the disadvantaged children, you've got to have early childhood development, cheapest money you'll ever spend. First contact should be with the mother when she's pregnant. That little child needs to be loved and hugged and nurtured and made to feel special, like your children were. They learn to think well or poorly themselves in the first 18 months.
Thank you, Mr.
And within
Brooks.
The first few years, they either learn how to learn or don't learn how to learn. And if they don't, they wind up in prison.
Thank you, Mr. Perot.
And it costs more to keep them in prison than it does to send them to Harvard. I rest my case.
Thank you. President Bush, you wanted to add something.
I just had a word of clarification because of something Governor Clinton said. My school choice program, GI Bill for Kids, does not take public money and give it to private schools. It does what the GI Bill itself did when I came out of World War II. Takes public money and gives it to families or individuals to choose the school they want. And where it's been done, those schools like in Rochester, those schools that weren't chosen, find that they then compete and do better. So I think it's worth a shot. We've got a pilot program. It ought to be tried. School choice, public, private, or religious, not to the schools, but to, you know, 46% of the teachers in Chicago, public school teachers, send their kids to private school. Now, I think we ought to try to help families and see if it will do what I think, make all schools better.
I just want to mention, if I could, just two
very briefly.
Very briefly. Involving the parents in the preschool education of their kids, even if they're poor and uneducated, can make a huge difference. We have a big program in my state that teaches mothers or fathers to teach their kids to get ready for school. It's the most successful thing we've ever done. Just a fact clarification, real quickly. We do not spend a higher percentage of our income on public education than every other country. There are 9 countries that spend more than we do on public education. We spend more on education because we spend so much more on colleges. But if you look at public education alone and you take into account the fact that we have more racial diversity and more poverty, it makes a big difference. There are great public schools where there's public school choice, accountability, and brilliant principals. I'll just mention one, the Beasley Academic Center in Chicago. I commend it to anybody. It's as good as any private school in the country.
We have very little time left, and it occurs to me that we have talked all this time, and there has not been one question about some of the racial tensions and ethnic tensions in America. Is there anyone in this audience that would like to pose a question to the candidates on this? Yes.
What I'd like to know, and this is to any of the three of you, is aside from the recent accomplishments of your party, aside from those accomplishments in racial representation, and without citing any of your current appointments or successful elections, when do you estimate your party will both nominate and elect an Afro-American and female ticket to the presidency of the United States?
Governor Clinton, why don't you answer that first?
Well, I don't have any idea, but I hope it will happen sometime in my lifetime.
I do too.
I believe that this country is electing more and more African Americans and Latinos and Asian Americans who are representing districts that are themselves not necessarily of a majority of their race. The American people are beginning to vote across racial lines, and I hope it will happen more and more. More and more women are being elected. Look at all these women Senate candidates we have here. And you know, according to my mother, my wife, and my daughter, this world would be a lot better place if women were running it most of the time. And I do think there are special experiences and judgments and backgrounds and understandings that women bring to this process, by the way. This lady said here, how have you been affected by the economy? I mean, women know what it's like to be paid an unequal amount for equal work. They know what it's like not to have flexible working hours. They know what it's like not to have family leave or child care. So I think it would be a good thing for America if it happened, and I think it will happen in my lifetime.
Okay, I'm sorry, we have just a little bit time left. Let's try to get responses from each of them. President Bush or Mr. Barrow?
If Barbara Burrow? Bush were running this year, she'd be elected. But it's too late. You don't want us to mention appointees, but when you see the quality of people in our administration, see how Colin Powell performed, I say administration, he's in... You weren't impressed with the fact that
I'm extremely impressed with that.
Yeah, but wouldn't that suggest to the American people then here's a quality person if he decided that he could automatically get the nomination of either party?
When's your guess?
Huh?
I'm totally impressed with that. I just want to know is when's your guess
and
when? Oh, I
see. You mean time?
Yeah.
I don't know. Starting after 4 years. I think you'll see more minority candidates and women candidates coming forward. This is supposed to be the women's year of the women in the Senate. Let's see how they do.
I don't want to cut you off anymore, but we only have a minute left.
I have a fearless forecast. Unless he just won't do it, Colin Powell will be on somebody's ticket 4 years from now. Right?
Yeah.
Right?
All right,
hey, you wanted that's it. 4 years.
How about a woman?
Now, if he won't be, General Waller would be a concern. Now, you say, why do you keep picking military people? These are people that I just happen to know and have a high regard for. I'm sure there are hundreds of others.
How about Dr. Lou Sullivan?
Absolutely.
Yeah, good man.
Absolutely.
What about a woman?
Well, I told you,
my candidate's back there.
Okay, I can think of many.
Many?
Absolutely.
When?
All right, how about Sandra Day O'Connor as
good.
An example?
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Bernardine Healy.
Good.
National Institute of Health. All right, I'll yield the floor. Name some more.
Thank you. Thank you. I want to apologize to our audience because there were 209 people here and there were 209 questions. We only got to a fraction of them, and I'm sorry to those of you that didn't get to ask your questions, but we must move to the conclusion of the program. It is time now for the two-minute closing statements, and by prior agreement, President Bush will go first.
May I ask for an exception? Because I think we owe Carol Simpson. Anybody can stand in between these three characters here and get the job done. We owe her a round of applause. So, but don't take it out of my time.
That's right.
I feel strongly about
Give
it, but I don't want it to come
time.
Out of my time. No, but let me just say to the American people, in 2.5 weeks, we're going to choose who should sit in this Oval Office, who to lead the economic recovery, who to be the leader of the free world, who to get the deficit down. Three ways to do that. One is to raise taxes. One is to reduce spending, controlling that mandatory spending. Another one is to invest and save and to stimulate growth. I do not want to raise taxes. I differ with the two here on that. I'm just not going to do that. I do believe that we need to control mandatory spending. I think we need to invest and save more. I believe that we need to educate better and retrain better. I believe that we need to export more, so I'll keep working for export agreements where we can sell more abroad. And I believe that we must strengthen the family. We've got to strengthen the family. Now let me pose this question to America. If in the next 5 minutes a television announcer came on and said, there is a major international crisis, there is a major threat to the world, or in this country, a major threat, my question is, who, if you were appointed to name one of the three of us, who would you choose? Who has the perseverance, the character, the integrity, the maturity to get the job done? I hope I'm that person. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Mr. President. And now a closing statement from Mr. Perot.
If the American people want to do it and not talk about it, then they ought to, you know, I'm one person they ought to consider. If they just want to keep slow dancing and talk about it and not do it, I'm not your man. I am results-oriented. I am action-oriented. I've built my businesses getting things done in 3 months that my competitors took 18 months to do. Everybody says you can't do that with Congress. Sure, you can do that with Congress. Congress is, they're all good people. They're all patriots, but you got to link arms and work with them. Sure, you'll have arguments. Sure, you'll have fights. We have them all day, every day, but we get the job done. Now, I have to come back in my close to one thing because I am passionate about education. I was talking about early childhood education for disadvantaged little children. And let me tell you one specific pilot program where children who don't have a chance go to this program when they're three. Now we're going back to when the mother is pregnant, and they'll start right after they're born. But starting when they're three and going to this school until they're nine, and then going into the public school in the fourth grade, 90% are on the honor roll. Now, that will change America. Those children will all go to college. They will live the American dream. And I beg the American people, anytime they think about reforming education, to take this piece of society that doesn't have a chance and take these little pieces of clay that can be shaped and molded and give them the same love and nurture and affection and support you give your children, and teach them that they're unique and that they're precious and there's only one person in the world like them, and you will see this nation bloom. And we will have so many people who are qualified for the top job that it will be terrific. Now, finally, if you can't pay the bills, you're dead in the water. And we have got to put our nation back to work. Now, if you don't want to really do that, I'm not your man. I'd go crazy sitting up there slow dancing that one. In other words, unless we're going to do it, then pick somebody who likes to talk about it. Now, just remember when you think about me, I didn't create this mess. I've been paying taxes just like you. And Lord knows I've paid my share. Over $1 billion in taxes. And for a guy that started out with everything he owned in the trunk of his car, that ain't bad.
Once again.
It's in your hands. I wish you well. I'll see you tomorrow night on NBC, 10:30, 11 Eastern.
And finally, last but not least, Governor Clinton.
Thank you, Carol, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Since I suggested this format, I hope it's been good for all of you. I really tried to be faithful to your request that we answer the questions specifically and pointedly. I thought I owed that to you, and I respect you for being here and for the impact you've had on making this a more positive experience. These problems are not easy. They're not going to be solved overnight. But I want you to think about just two or three things. First of all, the people of my state have let me be their governor for 12 years because I made commitments to two things: more jobs and better schools. Our schools are now better. Our children get off to a better start from preschool programs and smaller classes in the early grades, and we have one of the most aggressive adult education programs in the country. We talked about that. This year, my state ranks first in the country in job growth, fourth in manufacturing job growth, fourth in income growth, fourth in the decline of poverty. I'm proud of that. It happened because I could work with people, Republicans and Democrats. That's why we've had 24 retired generals and admirals, hundreds of business people, many of them Republican, support this campaign. You have to decide whether you want to change or not. We do not need 4 more years of an economic theory that doesn't work. We've had 12 years of trickle-down economics. It's time to put the American people first, to invest and grow this economy. I'm the only person here who's ever balanced the government budget, and I've presented 12 of them and cut spending repeatedly. But you cannot just get there by balancing the budget. We've got to grow the economy by putting people first, real people like you. I got into this race because I did not want my child to grow up to be part of the first generation of Americans to do worse than her parents. We're better than that. We can do better than that. I want to make America as great as it can be, and I ask for your help in doing it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Governor Clinton. Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes the debate sponsored by the Bipartisan Commission on Presidential Debates. I'd like to thank our audience of 209 uncommitted voters who may leave this evening, maybe being committed, and hopefully they'll go to the polls like everyone else on November 3rd and vote. We invite you to join us on the third and final presidential debate next Monday, October 19th, from the campus of Michigan State University in East Lansing, Michigan. I'm Carol Simpson. Good night.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. Thank you very much for joining us this evening. We're going to just talk for just a little bit with Jeffrey Birnbaum, who is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, covers Congress and politics most years, and has been traveling with the Clinton campaign. Jeffrey, I think, first of all, let's say that these citizen questioners did a very good job, and they dealt with very tough subjects, and I we didn't get any question that I would consider a crazy question, off-the-wall question, or a trivial question. They were asking about trade, about the deficit, about jobs. They were critical of the conduct of the campaign. Mm-hmm. Talked about infrastructure and crime. Very serious.
And very much from the heart, it seemed. A lot of the questions were very personal in nature. One woman in particular asking the candidates how they personally were affected by some of the troubles in the economy in particular.
I think that was one of the most interesting parts of the whole debate. When the woman said, "How has the national debt affected you?" I think Carol Simpson reinterpreted her question to mean, "How does the recession affect your life?" And
And there was this little moment of electricity as the candidates kind of tried to reach out to this woman who was reaching out to them.
Mm-hmm. It was a moment probably that President Bush wishes he could take back, I think, because he had to ask that woman to rephrase the question because he didn't quite understand it, which is could almost be a Clinton commercial in a certain way. At the same time, of course, President Bush did like, in fact, all three candidates, I think, comported themselves very well in this debate. I think the spin doctors are out now trying to say that each of them won, but I bet it would be hard for a lot of people to decide.
Early on in the debate, we had President Bush discuss character. He was asked, why do you spend so much time talking about each other? Why not talk about the issues? Why not try to reach consensus? And President Bush defended the fact that he is campaigning on Clinton's character. He said character is part of it. And he basically said, nobody likes who shot John, the president said, and then suggested that Governor Clinton had started the negative campaigning.
Right, and Clinton responded that he didn't want to be negative and that he hated waking up in the morning having to defend himself each day. And I think Clinton, though he tried mightily to stay off the negative attacks, did not succeed tonight. I think he used the term "read my lips" in a derisive sort of way. It was clear, though, that the audience, there was a moment when Carol Simpson, the moderator, asked the audience what they thought of the conduct of the campaign, and you could see here in the stadium that we're sitting in that the virtually the entire audience said that they didn't like the negative campaigning. It was clear, though, that neither Bush nor Clinton could really stay away from it.
The very last thing that that Ross Perot said in his closing statement was, if the American people want to do it and not talk about it, I'm your man. I'm the man who wants to pay the bills, not slow, go for me because I'll pay the bills. This is not slow dancing.
Right.
But apart from an answer about education programs, which is something he dealt with in great detail in the state of Texas, in reforming education there, there really was not. I mean, so far we're still getting from Ross Perot, there are lots of plans, you can solve the problems, you can deal with it, you just have to talk, but he doesn't ever tell us what. He doesn't ever get specific.
He did attempt in a few instances to get specific, but there were three specific questions where he declined to give any specifics. When he was asked about health care, when he was asked about gun control, and when he was asked about reforming the Social Security Trust Fund system. His answer each time was, there were a lot of very good solutions, and all we have to do is sit down and think about it, and we'll come up with the right answer. And then he launched into a very entertaining litany of his condemnation of lobbyists and special interest groups and PAC money, things we're now all familiar, are familiar aphorisms of Mr. Perot. But and in fact, both President Bush and Governor Clinton at least implicitly criticized Perot for not having his own plan on some of these subjects. It is Clinton who's running, for example, as the man with the plan, and he tried to contrast that with both Bush and Perot.
But once again, Mr. Perot did tell us all that he was going to be talking about what he wants to do on television, and that he's bought time on television, as he said several times, on NBC, so that perhaps on his own paid television time he might tell us a few more details about what he actually plans to do.
He probably will talk a lot about the deficit. And he does have some ideas about cutting the deficit, but maybe not these other subjects, which he obviously considers ancillary.
Not too much. I don't think we really learned anything from the candidates that we didn't know. We didn't hear any new schemes, any new ideas, as far as I can tell. But I think it is interesting how Governor Clinton, who did say several times that this was the format that he favored, this was his idea,
Governor Clinton certainly does seem to be comfortable in this format. He did a program very much like this on MTV. He has done the television talk shows. He even had his own private version of it, which he paid for during the course of the campaign, mm-hmm. which were televised, essentially television talk shows. And he did strive to be relatively specific. Now, I wonder how that will work, how people will respond to that.
That will be the question over the next few days, whether the very clever answers of Ross Perot, whether the calls for maturity, the appeals to maturity and character made by President Bush, or whether the staccato sort of point-by-point plan suggested by Clinton during this hour and a half will be what appeals most to the American voters. But we did see three different characters of debate going on here. It is fair to say, though, I think that Clinton was most practiced at this method and seemed to use the format more than the others, walking around much more, stepping closer to the camera. It was sort of a ballet that we saw being played out here, everyone taking their own position, trying to get the best angle. It was a kind of a three-dimensional chess that we saw dancing in front of us.
We did see one particular occasion. Mr. Clinton did sort of strike out at the president on the question of enterprise zones. This was an answer to a question on infrastructure. The president talks about passing bills. Talks about his program for enterprise zones, talked about going to South Central Los Angeles. And Carol Simpson, who was the moderator, pointed out to him that such a bill had passed and that he had decided to veto it. And Clinton immediately came back with yes and decided to veto it because it taxed rich people more than the president wanted
people. Which is an oversimplification in itself, but a probably a better than fair debating point in his favor. I think we did see a pretty good exposition from President Bush and Governor Clinton of their different views of government. Where we had Clinton talking about a more activist government, investment is how he described it, and acknowledging the tax increases were necessary, but he was very careful to say only on wealthy people and foreign corporations. President Bush took a very different view of government, saying that he wanted less government in almost all subjects, health care in particular, and he was emphatic about his opposition to taxes, while at the same time admitting that he had made a mistake in 1990 by breaking his no new taxes pledge and signing what was then the second largest tax increase in history.
It was the tone of this debate, though, despite a couple of little back and forth, the president on character, Clinton on making a crack about read my lips and so on, the tone could hardly be more different from the tone of the vice presidential debate. And Jeffrey Birnbaum, we had given some thought to the possibility that the president might follow his vice president and really try to get very tough and very aggressive. He didn't.
No, he did not get aggressive, but I think the point that he made about character, I mean, he really put it on the line. He didn't do it in a nasty way, but he did put it as baldly and boldly as we've heard it at any time here. Whether he essentially asked people to decide whether they thought Governor Clinton had the maturity and character to be president, implying that he, in fact, did have those and that Governor Clinton did not. And Clinton had a very, very strong response to that, of course, which was that he was an experienced governor and that he had a vision for the future that people could put their trust in.
The president closed by raising that whole point again, saying, imagine that there is some kind of major threat to the country, either from abroad or even in this country. Who would you choose? Who has the character, the maturity to get the job done. And I think that that is the essential question that the president is trying to make the American people think about, whereas Governor Clinton is pouring out a barrage of ideas, plans, and specifics and saying, here's what I'm going to do to change things. Mm-hmm. And Ross Perot is telling us that if we're tired of slow dancing and we want somebody who doesn't talk about it, we should go for Ross Perot. But so far as I can tell, all he has done is talk about it.
Right. Surely that criticism will be registered. And to fill out your point here, Clinton tried to make the point, I think, that he does have the character, that he has stood and balanced budgets in his own state and has a fairly good economic record from his own state, which President Bush did not attack tonight, I think we should point out. At the same time, Governor Clinton did not directly answer some of these charges, trying to, I guess, at least at that point, stay away from mudslinging.
This was, I think it's fair to say, the kind of discussion that the voters we've talked to during the course of this campaign have been asking for, and that is a calm, quiet, rather detailed series of questions in which the candidates are asked for specifics, and in some cases, I think they provided them. Thanks very much, Jeffrey Birnbaum, who is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. He is, at this moment, covering the Clinton campaign, normally covers Congress and politics. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to National Public Radio's live coverage of the second of three presidential debates. This was at the University of Richmond in Richmond, Virginia. There's one more debate planned next Monday night at Michigan State University in East Lansing. Part of that debate will be a single moderator. Part of it will be a panel of reporters. So we'll still another format to experiment with that begins at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Monday night. The technical director for this broadcast is Arthur Halliday-Laurent. Our engineers in Washington are Michael Cullen and Norb Gallery. We had production assistance from Jane Holmes and Kristen Cuff. Our producer is John Cater. Thanks very much to the staff of the University of Richmond and to the Commission on Presidential Debates for their assistance, and to ComSat Mobile Systems for technical support. Thanks also to Jeffrey Birnbaum of the Wall Street Journal for joining us this evening. From the Robbins Arena at the University of Richmond, I'm Linda Wertheimer. Good evening from Richmond.